Welcome, thesis-driven subscribers and Leader Series listeners. I'm Brad Hargraves, the host of the Leader Series, and we have a really exciting show for all of you today. Our guest will be Steve Case. Steve has had a really incredible 40-year entrepreneurial journey in which he's not only done some incredible things on his own, he's been one of the foremost supporters of entrepreneurship, innovation, and emerging cities across the United States. Steve got his start back 40 years ago when he co-founded America Online, one of the quintessential brands of the first wave of internet innovation. He stepped down as CEO in 2000 after the merger with Time Warner, and since took a much more public sector approach to his career. He started Revolution, which invests in new ventures, but he also partnered up with the White House to really shape how the public sector and the federal government approaches entrepreneurship and innovation throughout the country. And that's really put him on the forefront of thinking about how cities evolve and how technology and cities interrelate. He was one of the architects of the Jobs Act during the Obama administration and started helping the federal government and the White House think about what cities are really primed for innovation and new technological growth. And out of that came the book for which he's best known, Rise of the Rest. This idea that there are a handful of cities, mostly away from the coasts, that are really primed to be the incubators of the next generation of great technology companies. So we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about how that has emerged since the pandemic, which in a lot of ways accelerated Case's vision, and where he sees things going in terms of technology, in terms of cities, and in terms of venture capital. Remember, he's making a lot of investments as well over the next decade. So really excited for this show with one of the premier innovators of the past 40 years. Let's jump in. Steve, welcome to the Thesis Driven Leader Series. So excited to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Brad.
Awesome. So you had an incredibly illustrious career in business, running companies prior to starting Revolution and writing a lot of really interesting things about the intersection of technology, cities, and the future. What got you excited in these topics? You know, what in your business career got you into this?
Well, most of my career as an entrepreneur was focused around the internet. We started America Online, AOL, almost four decades ago, and it was still more of an idea. Only 3% of people were online; they're only online an hour a week, and so that was really the center of my life and activity for really a couple of decades. And then after I stepped down as CEO of that company, when we merged with Time Warner, I started focusing on backing the next generation of entrepreneurs. And that's when I started Revolution here in Washington, D.C. But quickly, I became interested, maybe some would say even a little obsessed, with the fact that the vast majority of venture capital was going to just a few cities. About 75% of venture capital has been going to California, New York, and Massachusetts, and not enough venture capital is going to other parts of the country. And that really led us down the path of launching a Rise of the Rest as both a strategy to help support more thriving startup communities and also as a fund to back entrepreneurs all over the country. And we did it in part because we were trying to drive impact and job creation in these cities, but mostly because we thought it was a differentiated investment strategy. And if you were able to build the network to identify promising companies in different cities, you generally would be able to invest at a lower valuation than if that same company was in Silicon Valley. And so there was a little bit of an arbitrage there, where because the so much venture capital was focused on a few places like Silicon Valley.
Right. So you saw this trend pretty early on. So you wrote about it in Third Wave, which I believe came out in 2016. And writing about this emergence of startup ecosystems, technology outside of gateway cities, what did you see? What were you looking at, watching, that clued you into this trend?
Well, actually, I started on this journey a little bit before that. I was asked probably now 13 years ago, 14 years ago, to lead an effort called the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship. That led to a series of recommendations. I was asked by then President Obama to launch an effort called Startup America, a White House initiative to promote regional entrepreneurship, again, more than a decade ago, and then worked on the Jobs Council on something called the Jobs Act that passed Congress over a decade ago. So that was sort of the backstory. It got me focused on the intersection of technology and policy, particularly around entrepreneurship, and got me focused on this dynamic where you know, because most of the capital was in a few places, it was advantaging those cities and disadvantaging other cities. And then about 10 years ago, we launched our Rise of the Rest bus tour. The first tour with cities like Detroit and Pittsburgh that were kind of the centerpieces of innovation 100 years ago, kind of the Industrial Revolution, the car revolution, but then had kind of lost their way and were trying to figure out a way to fight their way back by backing the next generation of startups, and did a number of bus tours over a number of years, ended up visiting about 50 cities, and then decided 6-7 years ago to launch an early stage seed fund, the Rise of the Rest seed fund, to back these entrepreneurs. And those funds so far have backed about 200 companies in 100 different cities, 38 different states, so fairly broad all across the country. So it started with a focus on policy and then even a little bit on philanthropy, because we were making in grants to a lot of different organizations, a lot of different cities. And then we pivoted, said, well, we really believe in this. Let's put our money where our mouth is and launch a fund that can prove that you can generate, you know, top tier returns by backing entrepreneurs in these Rise of the Rest cities.
I remember the bus tours now. I was running General Assembly at the time, which was a trade school for tech and design. And yeah. That was when these tours were happening, going to places that people hadn't necessarily thought about in the technology landscape, and identifying some very, very cool things that were happening there. So let's talk about this list in these cities, because, you know, people in real estate, our audience, they're always looking for what's next. What are the next generation of places that are going to rise? So you wrote Rise of the Rest, have it here. Awesome book. And it came out in 2022. So how did you arrive? I mean, I assume you were writing it kind of mid-pandemic. How did you arrive at this, you know, particular like list of cities and the conclusions there, given everything that was going on in the world at the time?
Well, again, because we've been working on this, you know, for nearly a decade pre-pandemic, and we also saw in the early days of the pandemic some trends, which, you know, aren't that surprising, and I'm sure you and your audience are well aware of them, where because of the pandemic, suddenly it opened some opportunities in terms of more remote work, more hybrid work, that kind of unbundling where you work and how you work, and either where you work and how you live, and that created some flexibility that hadn't existed for a lot of people prior to that, which then accelerated some of the trends in these Rise of the Rest cities. It accelerated sort of some talent dispersion, that a lot of people grew up in different parts of the country, but then left because the opportunity was better on the coast, better in places like Silicon Valley. Some of them boomeranged back during the, you know, the pandemic and continued to work for the existing company, but did it more remotely. And that was a positive in terms of what was happening in terms of the sort of the talent flows. And also, not surprisingly, we saw a number of companies start in that early days of the pandemic as more fully remote companies, saying we're going to really design a company that allows us to build a strong culture and, you know, a lot of collaboration using a variety of different tools and offsites and things like that, but tap into a national or even global workforce, as opposed to presuming that we can only be attracting people that happen to live in the city that we're currently living in. That also created some opportunity. But the big takeaway, which is actually part of the reason to write the book and tell the stories of lots of different companies in lots of different cities building lots of different, you know, kind of startups targeting, you know, a variety of different sectors, was it wasn't one or two or three cities on the rise. It really was several dozen cities on the rise. And that, to me, was the most encouraging, you know, point. And going back to your theme and around real estate, we also, early on, when we started these bus tours a decade ago, saw in pretty much every city we visited, a neighborhood that was being reimagined kind of as an innovation district that became a place where the entrepreneurs started clustering. And we quickly identified that that was an opportunity not just to invest in those companies, but invest in real estate in those cities, particularly in those neighborhoods. And it wasn't our primary focus at the time. We actually, when we were on these tours, would talk it up, hoping somebody else would do it. I remember having a meeting, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago with senior people, Blackstone, John Gray, and others, and encouraged them to launch sort of a Rise the Rest real estate strategy. We said, we can tell you what cities are on the rise. We can even tell you what neighborhoods within those cities are showing real momentum. And just seemed like an interesting opportunity. And then we were approached, I guess now probably five years ago, by Hines, very successful regional developer, about potentially partnering. And maybe we do a joint venture around Rise the Rest because they really liked what we're doing and saw that the network we're building could be advantageous. But it was just complicated to put a structure together, just particularly given how decentralized Hines was. But ultimately, several of the people we were talking to ended up joining Revolution to launch a Rise of the Rest real estate strategy here. And we've now done projects in Huntsville, St. Louis, Madison, a number of cities that really are investing in the underlying real estate that can be supportive of these startup communities. And we're seeing tremendous momentum in those cities.
So I want to put a pin in that because I do want to come back and talk about what, Clint Myers and Starlin Kousey are the two people on your team are doing, two of my favorite people in real estate today. But I want to go back to this kind of list of cities and what unifies them, what shared traits do they have before we get into the real estate investing thesis, because I think that's really interesting. If you look at the list of cities, we talked about some of them in the introduction, places like Huntsville, like Nashville, like Salt Lake City, that's where a ton of investment has happened on the multifamily side. Those are basically the markets you wanted to be in, certainly from 2015 to 2022. And even the cities that I think weren't necessarily part of that run-up, places like Indianapolis, now are some of the hottest multifamily markets in the country here in 2024, where we sit today. So kind of what made... Go a level deeper on what were those shared characteristics of those cities that made them compelling?
Well, there are a number of things. One area to focus on is which are the cities that are kind of winning the battle for talent instead of losing talent, sort of a brain drain. They're seeing they're a magnet for talent, both people who left returning, the boomerang factor I talked about, as well as other people who didn't really have a connection to that city moving to that city. That's a key driver. Also winning the battle for capital. How do you make sure that you're able to attract the venture capital that's necessary to start and scale companies, both by having regional venture firms in your city or near your city, as well as tapping into sort of the national firm, particularly the ones on the coast. So the talent piece is critical. The capital piece is critical. There's also a key piece around culture and collaboration and building community. And that's a big focus of what we try to do over the last decade. So there is more connectivity in these communities. It is a little easier for the entrepreneurs to start and scale, a little easier for them to connect to people that might be investors or partners or customers or things like that. So that's one set of factors. Another set of factors is if a city has a strong research university, how do you really tap into that? They are magnets for talent. They attract people who are there for PhDs and things like that, but often they leave. How do you get more of those people to stay and more of the ideas generated on campus into the hands of entrepreneurs to create companies? And also, how do you build on what's unique about your city? What gives it a competitive advantage? What gives it some differentiation? And some cities are differentiated by having particular sectors where they really have strength in that. Northwest Arkansas, there's a lot around logistics because companies like Walmart are headquartered there. Detroit, there's a lot around mobility because obviously that's where the cars have been centered for really most of the last century. Pittsburgh done a lot of things around robotics, partly because Carnegie Mellon is arguably the best robotics university, research university in the world. There's a different dynamics that different cities have that give them that kind of competitive advantage. So those are some of the factors that are in play. But the other, and it ties in with one of the cities you mentioned, Indianapolis, is when you have a successful company, what we think is a tentpole company that gets to the point where it's really scaled and has potentially thousands of employees and a multi-billion dollar or more valuation, that then leads to dynamic where some of the people that were there at that company early and learned how to start and scale a company and made some money on stock options or founder equity then tend to think about the next generation of entrepreneurs. And it creates this momentum, this network effect, this positive, you know, kind of increasing return cycle. And that's what happened in Indianapolis. Success of Exact Target, founded by entrepreneur Scott Dorsey, got acquired by Salesforce, became Salesforce's second largest office outside of San Francisco itself. And over time, in the last decade, several dozen enterprise software companies have started in the Indianapolis. And most of those are people that were working at Exact Target. Many of those are people that are incubated or backed by Scott Dorsey and his fund. So that's another dynamic that kicked in. So there's many different factors that drive the cities that are on the move, the cities that are rising fastest.
I love that because you hear a lot about cities leaning into their unique advantage. I think Pittsburgh is an incredible example of, great, they have Carnegie Mellon, they have all this robotics talent. It's a no-brainer for them to lean into that. And they've been very successful and bucked a lot of trends of the Rust Belt because of that. It's a lot trickier to think about how do you develop that initial advantage. And sometimes you look at agglomeration, it's just about having that initial multi-billion dollar company, that multi-billion dollar idea that develops that talent pool, something like Exact Target in Indianapolis. It's a great story.
We saw that here in the Northern Virginia area with AOL and some other entrepreneurial companies several decades ago, like MCI. The success led to other successes. That's part of the Austin story. The success of Dell coupled with the South by Festival really helped build momentum around Austin. Seattle half a century ago was really troubled. You know, the city in decline. You know, Microsoft was headquartered there only because, you know, basically Bill Gates and Paul Allen were born and raised in Seattle and wanted to go home. So they actually started Microsoft in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and after a few years decided to move home and really built it in Seattle. The only reason Amazon is in Seattle is Jeff Bezos, when, you know, working at a hedge fund in New York City, decided to launch an internet company focused on commerce, initially focused on books. And he moved to Seattle for one reason. He wanted to pick off some Microsoft engineers to actually build the website. Right. So now, because of the success of Microsoft, the success of Amazon and other companies, Costco and others, you know, Seattle's on the move. You see that, you know, that dynamic where the success of one or several companies really creates this broader ripple effect over time.
And sometimes it can cross real estate sectors too. I mean, you look at Northern Virginia as a great example. People ask, why are there so many data centers in Northern Virginia? Why is the data center business centered in that particular region? Well, AOL and a lot of the early internet companies were there. And you can go back and back of like, how does that origin then of those early internet companies cross categories and now create, you know, what is probably one of the most exciting categories of real estate right now, which is data centers, which energy cost aside.
Yeah, correct. The success of AOL was certainly part of it, but also the internet itself was basically birthed in Northern Virginia. DARPA, the Defense Research Agency that funded the initial internet to build a network that essentially was distributed enough that it could sustain a nuclear attack, that was basically in Northern Virginia. So some of the brains that made that possible and even the government funding that made it possible was in Northern Virginia. So, you know, that history coupled with the success of AOL, our peak 20 plus years ago, about half of all the internet traffic in the United States went through AOL, went through Northern Virginia. So that then creates that momentum and then the agglomeration effect that you talked about earlier.
So let's go back to the starting new companies. You know, Revolution is, I don't want to say primarily, but it has a big venture fund component of it, correct? So I know there's Revolution Growth, there's a Rise of the Rest Seed. Let me talk a little bit about your role as a VC and the relationship between your venture work and your advocacy work for these emerging cities.
Well, Revolution started almost 20 years ago as really my family office. The first investments we made, companies like Exclusive Resorts and Zipcar and other things, were basically investments I was funding personally. And then a little over a decade ago, we decided to open it up to outside LPs and have institutional investors in our various funds. You mentioned Revolution Growth, which is the later stage fund. We also have Revolution Ventures. We have the Rise the Rest Seed Fund, and we also have the Rise the Rest Real Estate Strategy. And so that's how it scaled, and we're now positioned to back entrepreneurs kind of at every stage of the journey, that very early seed stage, the next venture stage, or the later growth stage. And we do have, not surprisingly, a bias, not just with Rise the Rest, but more broadly, on companies where place does matter. And we have a pretty good network all across the country now. So we identify promising entrepreneurs in these other cities. We back some great companies like Tempus using AI in Chicago, or TemperPack, which focuses on sustainable packaging in Richmond, Virginia, that are later stage growth investments. Here in Washington, D.C., where we're headquartered, we back two fast casual concepts that started here, Sweetgreen and Cava. So we have this regional orientation around place. And we also have a bias towards policy. We believe the next wave of really interesting disruptive companies are going to have a policy aspect to them. And that's because the sectors that are now starting to get reimagined, get disrupted, like healthcare and education, food and agriculture, financial services, they all have a policy angle to them. Healthcare, for example, is 1/6 of the economy. There are regulations around healthcare, and understanding that is critical to be successful in those industries. So we're looking for companies at Revolution that obviously are great ideas, great entrepreneurs, great teams that can scale them, but also have some dynamic around place and or policy.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been great to follow Revolution. It's been a really interesting model combining various stages of investment. Also, obviously, the connection to regulated industries, I think, is and the built environment has put you in a really, really interesting spot. So let's now pivot to the real estate side. So it's a much newer initiative within Revolution, the Rise of the Rest Real Estate Fund. Obviously, you started with a thesis around specific cities. How do you go about translating that thesis of we believe in these cities into a real estate thesis of we should buy these assets at these prices and execute this business plan?
Well, a little backstory. 20 years ago, we were just getting started. We did make a number of real estate and hospitality related investments. We're big landowners in Hawaii, for example, about 40,000 acres in the island of Kauai, which has a variety of different initiatives going on. We're also the majority shareholder of a company called Maui Land, and Pineapple owns a Kapalua resort. We own a company called Exclusive Resorts, which is a kind of a club concept around destination vacations. We're developing a peninsula in Costa Rica, a 600-acre peninsula that's anchored by a Waldorf. And those are things that got started quite some time ago. So there's some experience in the real estate hospitality world. But when we were expanding Rise the Rest, and you mentioned Starling and Clint, and we were talking to them about doing something together, we said, well, we know what's happening in these cities. We know they're on the rise. We know as there is more economic development, there is more startup activity, there is more job creation, people will be moving to these cities. And over time, that creates a real estate opportunity. So the initial focus was looking in these rising cities, focused particularly on opportunity zones, focused particularly on mixed-use projects, and focused particularly on partnering with some regional developers who had expertise in those particular markets. That was the initial focus, and the projects we've done so far in the various cities have kind of fit in that mode. Now we're, like many of your listeners, also looking at some potential buying opportunities because of what's happening in the market. We're also looking beyond some of the initial mixed-use developments at some potential opportunities in the housing space, more accessible housing, workforce housing, could be of interest in a number of these different cities. So it's expanded, but it builds on the strategy of Rise the Rest, which is because of the nature of a seed fund and the number of investments we've made, we don't lead those seed rounds. We partner with regional venture firms. We're trying to create more of a network of these regional venture firms. And so we're an investor as part of a larger round, and the regional firms take the lead day to day in terms of being on the board and things like that. And that strategy also is what we've adopted around our real estate initiative. We want to be catalytic. We want to be helpful in terms of bringing some of our expertise to bear, but we want to partner with people around the country that really have expertise about their particular markets.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. How do you get that local expertise on the ground? So, you're coming in, you're bringing a broader set of expertise. You're also bringing capital. So are you coming in kind of as an LP to these deals with local GPs?
No, we're more of an active partner kind of early on. So we're not just providing LP capital. We're part of the, you know, part of the projects, but we're not doing it on our own. We're trying to do it in partnership with others. We've also made some investments on the venture side in companies that have a, you know, kind of a real estate kind of, you know, kind of, or in their prop tech dynamic. We're early backers of a company, City Winery, that started in New York, now expanded around the country to other cities. And part of that is real estate. They, you know, for example, bought a property in Nashville a decade ago in an area that was at the time, you know, kind of just going to be redeveloped, and sold that property 10 years later. I think it was a 5x return just on the real estate side of that, even though they're primarily a hospitality business, winery, restaurant, you know, music venues. They've also had a, you know, kind of a real estate aspect to that. We've backed a, you know, Convene, which is a company focused on meeting space. We backed Mint House and Placemaker that focused on reimagining buildings around hotel properties. We backed HomeSnap, which then was acquired by CoStar, also in the real estate space. So there is some focus on the venture side as well on sort of prop tech and some of the other related real estate hospitality, you know, businesses, as well as having a dedicated team working on the real estate. And obviously we see some synergies between some of those businesses. For, you know, for example, one of the investments we made on the real estate side in St. Louis, City Winery, is also, you know, kind of a part of that project.
So, I did not know you were a backer of City Winery. Their New York location on the Hudson River is, I think, my favorite music venue in the city. It's not huge; it's pretty small, but I've been to some great shows there. So I'm a big fan of that business. So,
interesting. They said their business was started as more of an entertainment business, but they quickly realized that because of their draw, they could build these clubs in places which had lower cost real estate and generate great returns on that real estate. Their initial New York location was in Soho. Eventually it got sold and they moved to the location you mentioned. So it's basically a business, and other businesses we have, like exclusive resorts, are similar. There's a dynamic that sort of drives the demand that then, you know, kind of feeds what ends up being a pretty attractive real estate opportunity.
One of my favorite things about City Winery, and then I'll get back to our program, is they've designed a venue that artists love to play in. So you can tell that they punch above their weight in terms of the quality of artists they're able to get for the size venue they are, because it is such a, like, low-key focused venue that probably attracts the kind of people they want to attract. And I've seen a number of artists there at larger venues and at City Winery, and it's clear they enjoy playing at City Winery more. So I love that. Great job on that. Punching above their weight.
Helpful to have a little bit of a network. When they had one location in New York is one thing. Now they have a number of locations, different cities. Some of the artists, for exactly the reason you mentioned, do kind of City Winery tours where they, you know, New York and Boston and you know, Nashville and some of the other cities. And so they just like the venue. They like the way they're treated. So they want to do special tours just for City Winery. That even gets easier as City Winery expands to other cities.
And they're building AEG from the ground up. I love it. So I want to hear about how you pick food groups. So, you know, you do a lot of hospitality, and I love that. But, you know, going into a new city, you know, hospitality is somewhat limited in how much you can scale it. So how do you think about the opportunities across, you know, multifamily, office, single family, and decide where you want to place bets?
Well, as I said, the initial focus was on mixed-use projects in rising cities in opportunity zones. Now we're looking at a number of projects that can broaden, you know, the focus for exactly the reasons you mentioned. So we are definitely looking at multifamily in some of these cities. And while we're still looking at some, you know, build opportunities, we're also looking at some buying and reimagining kind of opportunities. So, and it depends on the partners in those cities, depends on obviously the dynamics in those cities. So we're, you know, sort of based on specific opportunities that emerge, but we still see this mega trend over the next, you know, decade that it was crazy to me, a little bit like I said about venture capital when we got started with Rise to Rest over a decade ago. the fact that overwhelming amounts of institutional capital were focused on just a small number of cities. This is, you know, the similar dynamic in terms of a lot of institutional capital focused on real estate a decade ago really was focused on the big gateway city. They wanted to be in New York. They wanted to be in London. They wanted to be in these, you know, major cities. And there was less focus on some of the regional opportunities, in part because the check sizes were small and they're looking, the big firms were looking to deploy lots of capital, but also because of some of the complexities of some of these cities. So generally, it was being left to the regional developers in terms of those, you know, cities, and that's starting to change. People now realize that there are really significant opportunities in various cities, and that's what we're focused on as well.
So I want to go back to this question of technology and the role of technology. So A few weeks ago, we had Dan Doktoroff of Sidewalk Labs on the show. And, you know, obviously Sidewalk was formed and driven by a very, I would say, maximalist view of the role technology is going to play in the future of cities. You know, there are a few people out there who know more about the intersection of technology and cities kind of on both sides than you. I'd be curious kind of where you sit on that spectrum of how big of an impact do you think tech writ large is going to have on urban development and on the arc of cities over the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, I think it's going to be important. It might be a little longer than a little shorter because these things tend to take a while. I remember even with, you know, autonomous vehicles, it's got a lot of momentum a decade ago. I was a little more skeptical because it wasn't just building the technology, it was building confidence for people to use it and communities and to allow it. And those things tend to take a little bit longer. I think some of the sidewalk challenges in Toronto were, you know, they were trying to do so much, it just became something that people in the community just got a little nervous about. So you have to kind of walk before you run. You have to build credibility. You have to build, you know, kind of goodwill, you know, build trust before people are willing to do a lot of different things. I think the one to watch now, it's, you know, been a little controversial, but the NEOM project in Saudi Arabia, which is really an effort to start from scratch with, a, you know, basically dirt and build an entire, you know, city and even think about new laws as well as new technologies. That's the one end of the spectrum. In most cases, it's really, and I, you know, you do deal with this all the time and your audience does, is dealing with existing, you know, kind of cities with existing, you know, governance and existing rules and regulations, and that makes it complicated. And some of the efforts, for example, around, you know, permitting to allow and zoning to allow different kinds of things to be built are challenges. Some of the rules around trying to repurpose existing buildings, maybe moving from office to residence is challenging. And so you just have to recognize these are challenges. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about part of our focus at Revolution around not just the technology and what's possible, but also the role of policy to enable what you want to do, I think is critically important. It's not just about the idea, it's about building support for the idea. And that's true increasingly in real estate as well.
Yeah, I see this a lot with people coming from the technology side, not necessarily understanding the policy requirements of a lot of these changes. Curious your take. You know, we've talked a lot about the rise of the rest cities and their emergence, but, you know, many of our listeners sit in New York, San Francisco, DC. What's your view on the future of big gateway hubs?
Oh, I still think there's a lot of value in some of these big gateway cities, and obviously a lot of reasons to be there: people, entertainment, culture. You know, so I think this is sort of the doom loop, doom and gloom around these big cities is overdrawn. Even San Francisco obviously has had some challenges. You know, Park Hotels closed or basically gave up two big hotels, several thousand rooms, because they really didn't see a recovery in the downtown area. I think there will be some challenges, obviously, particularly in central business districts, and that likely will continue for some period of time. But in the long run, I think there is value to being clustered, value to agglomeration, and there'll be value to these big cities. But I think the mega theme, which is what we've obviously been working on now for over a decade with Rise of the Rest, is instead of just assuming all the action is going to be in a small number of these big gateway cities. We're seeing it more distributed. So now there are dozens of cities that are really showing a lot of momentum around, you know, startups, innovation, you know, things like that. And many of these cities, as you know, are great cities to live in, you know, for lifestyle reasons. They have their own advantages and having more flexibility to pursue whatever path you want to pursue, whatever career you want to pursue, and have more flexibility in terms of, you know, where you live and how you work, I think is important. It reminds me a little bit of what's happened in the entertainment industry. There's 100 years ago, if you wanted to be in the, you know, movie business or the music business, you kind of had to be in Hollywood. That was where the action was. Now there's still advantages to be in Hollywood. A lot of people choose to be in Hollywood, but obviously the entertainment has moved beyond Hollywood, and many, many great firms great production companies are located in other places. That's what's happening now in the tech sector, the startup sector. So the big cities will still have some advantages, still be attractive to people, need to do some reimagining some parts of it, including the central business district, including how to think about some of the office areas, particularly in those central business districts where there isn't a lot of residential, there is not a lot of things going on evenings and weekends. Obviously, there needs to be more thinking and on that, and more flexibility in terms of the zoning to allow more you know, creativity in that space. But I'm a big believer in cities. I just am glad to see that there's now more flexibility in terms of how people can make decisions, and more cities as a result are benefiting from the dynamics around job growth, economic growth, which I think bodes well for those cities and also bodes well more broadly for the country.
Yeah, I think this is fundamentally democratizing, that you don't have to be in Silicon Valley to be in tech. You don't have to be in Hollywood to be in entertainment. Maybe you still have to be in New York to be in finance. Not really.
There's still a lot of firms in other places, and a lot of people move to, you know, Florida or other places.
That is true.
And so I think you don't have to be there. You might choose to be there. There might, you know, still be some advantages to be there, but you don't have to be there. And I think that is the game changer for so many industries.
So I want to end before we get into the lightning round with, you know, talking about a really salient issue in today's political environment. Immigration has become the hot button topic in this election. You have long advocated for immigration reform. It's a topic you've spoken about a lot. Tell us a little bit about your approach here and why you think it's relevant for the 2024 election.
Well, I certainly understand that immigration's complicated. There are many facets to it, and there's a lot of emotion to it. And so I understand that. But the part that I've been particularly focused on over the last decade is, how does America continue to win what's now a global battle for talent? Part of the reason America is the leading, you know, leader of the free world is we have the leading economy in the world. And part of the reason for that is we have built over the last 250 years the most innovative entrepreneurial, you know, kind of nation in the world. And part of that is because we've been a magnet for talent. About 40% of the Fortune 500 companies were started by immigrants or children of immigrants, but almost half of the, you know, tech companies in Silicon Valley, you know, started by immigrants or children of immigrants. That's part of the American story. And we want to continue to lead. We want to continue to out-innovate China and other countries. We want to continue to have the most robust innovation economy, the best economic growth. We have to, you know, continue to be that magnet for talent. Of course, we want to make sure we do a better job than we're doing on educating the kids who are born and raised in America to also be able to be participating in building kind of the industries of the future, the jobs of the future. But we also need to remember what got us to now, which is being that, you know, beacon of hope and opportunity, being attractive to people all around the world who want to live in America and start companies here. And these immigrants are, you know, job makers, not job takers. So that needs more focus. And it's unfortunate it gets caught up in the broader immigration debate. It gets caught up in the broader political debate. It's now hyper-partisanship around things like immigration. You saw that recently just in the last week or so in Congress in terms of what's happened around border security. But we can't lose sight of, we can't take for granted that America will continue to lead. There are clearly our global threats to, you know, our continued leadership in innovation, entrepreneurship. And even this week, I was at the White House yesterday most of the day because the National Advisory Council on Innovation Entrepreneurship that I got started more than a decade ago, I was asked to co-chair again, and we laid out a series of recommendations around innovation, around entrepreneurship to make sure America continues to lead. A lot of them were about these place-based things we've talked about, Rise of the Rest and other things, but part of it also was make sure we do take the necessary steps to be attractive and continue to be a strong immigrant nation.
I love it. A mentality of abundance, which is sorely needed today. So Before we wrap, I want to move into the lightning round, which are kind of quick questions, quick answers, how you're thinking about and feeling about certain things today. So let's jump in. So what is one startup, developer, or entrepreneur you're watching really closely today and why?
That's a tough question because across our various funds, we back 250 companies.
Got a lot of them.
Of course, we love all of them. It's like asking a parent what their favorite child is. Now we have some grandkids. What are your favorite grandchild is? But I'd say if I really had to pick one, it's a company we've been involved in for a number of years. I referenced it earlier, called Tempus AI in Chicago, and they really are doing some really interesting things using AI and ingesting data from lots of different medical institutions to more precisely diagnose cancer and in the process, you know, build a significant business and save a lot of lives. So that's one that I'm super excited to see what's happened since they started 5-6 years ago and what's going to happen for them over the next decade.
Awesome. That's a great one. If when we're recording this podcast in 10 years, in 2033, what is the number one thing we're talking about?
Well, I think it depends on, you know, we've covered a lot of different topics here in terms of innovation, entrepreneurship. I think you'll see a lot more momentum around place and, you know, more place-based policies. And even our government has passed things like the Chips and Science Act, starting to fund tech hubs. So I think that will be more central. So the ideas that have been bubbling over the last decade, including what we've been working on with Rise the Rest, I think will become much more mainstream. We'll have a more dispersed innovation economy, and that's positive. And the other dynamic that I think is going to be important, again, we've talked about it, is the role of policy is going to become more important. And the entrepreneurs of the future, whether it be real estate entrepreneurs or healthcare entrepreneurs or fintech entrepreneurs, are going to need to engage more on the policy front in order to be successful. And you're seeing that debate now in Washington, Brussels around AI. The innovators and the policymakers are having a discussion about ushering in the AI kind of revolution. That's going to become more commonplace. And the dorm room startups where, you know, people just launch something and it's an overnight success and they don't need to do anything related to regulations, you know, government policy, I think are going to be rarer 10 years from now.
Agreed. So if you could snap your fingers and change one real estate related law or policy, what would it be?
Well, we talked about it. Probably would be making it easier to, you know, to try new things, be more creative as we're trying to reimagine cities, including what we talked about in terms of central business districts or building new housing for people. There's a desire to have more affordable housing in many cities, but the costs associated with it, the regulations associated, the requirements that are put on those projects end up making them, you know, too expensive for most people. So just taking a fresh view of what's possible. And, you know, obviously most regulations are put in place because something bad happened and people don't want it to be bad again. But you also need to make sure you're not just keeping bad things from happening, you're also enabling good things to happen. And I think, right, a fresh look at some of the regulations around real estate and zoning around housing and reimagining existing buildings, building new buildings, definitely need to be rethought. And it's hard because it's at a city by city level, but most of them, but it's also makes it a little easier because you can have pockets of experimentation in some cities that other cities can learn from, and then that can accelerate the broader trends.
Absolutely. And this last question might be as tough for you as picking from your companies, but if there was one city or place you would bet on, what is it and why?
Yeah, that's a tough one. As I said, we've visited with our Rise Rest bus 50 cities. We've invested in 100 cities, and we're really championing all of them. I would say if I had to pick a city that I think is really well positioned for the next 10 or 20 years, it probably would be where we're based here in Washington, D.C., because of what's happening with its juxtaposition of technology and policy, some of the things happening around cyber, some of the things happening because Amazon picked this region for its second headquarters. So, you know, D.C. and greater D.C., including, you know, Maryland and Virginia, really are, I think, pretty well positioned. If I had to pick a comeback city that I continue to be passionate about, it'd have to be Detroit, the first city of our first Ride of the Rest tour. I visit at Detroit almost every year. We have a half a dozen investments there, companies like StockX and Shinola and several others. And that's a great example of the arc of the American story, where 100 years ago, it was essentially Silicon Valley when cars were the technology of the day. lost its way. Actually, the year before we came with our bus, the city of Detroit went bankrupt, and it's been fighting its way back. And the progress it's made over the last decade, still have a lot of challenges, but the progress they've made, particularly in the downtown Detroit area, really is remarkable. So DC, in terms of some of the macro trends, you know, Detroit in terms of a great American city that's showing a remarkable comeback.
Yeah, they've done a great job rejuvenating their core and starting from there, building out. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. You know, one of the foremost entrepreneurs at the intersection of technology and cities, great investor, author of Rise of the Rest. Encourage everyone to check it out. Steve, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Brad. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that conversation with Steve Case. He is a really great thinker about the future of innovation, of cities, of venture capital, and the role technology plays in all of those. So hope you enjoyed that conversation. I know I did. And I also hope you join us next week for a conversation with Spencer Raskoff. Spencer is one of the top entrepreneurs in prop tech today. He is the founder of Zillow, which is probably the most influential platform for how homes get bought, sold, and discovered in the United States today. He stepped out of the role as CEO at Zillow a few years ago and has since been investing in and incubating new companies in that similar prop tech future of housing vein. One of those companies, for example, is Picasso, which is a fractional ownership platform that helps people own a share of vacation homes. But he's also made dozens of investments out of his venture platform, 75 and Sunny. So we're going to talk about what he looks for in new investments, as well as where he sees the future of housing and buying and selling housing going. So hope you can join in for that one as well. See you all next week.